Neither snow, nor rain, nor heat, nor gloom of night stays these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds. Now the U.S. Postal Service says no problem on mail-in voting, even if the president has doubts. And you're talking to us about it.
I retired from the United States Postal Service after a 30-year career. We always took ballot handling very seriously. It's an honorable responsibility.
It's really not fair to them, given all the other pressures that they're facing.
It's what we're talking about on The Takeaway for Wednesday, August 5th. Glad you're with me. I'm Tanzina Vega. Also, an explosion in Beirut rocks the area for miles around and causes an instant humanitarian crisis.
It does at the moment look like it was just a case of massive negligence, compounded with some question marks about why this extremely explosive material was being stored there at all.
Plus, why the life expectancy of hip-hop artists can be very low. But first, with less than 100 days left before the presidential election, the Trump administration has been attacking the United States Postal Service and the use of mail-in ballots. On Monday, the president tweeted that the Postal Service, quote, could never handle the traffic of mail-in votes without preparation. The Postal Service responded, saying it is prepared for the onslaught of ballots. But President Trump has had his eye on undermining the Postal Service for years. According to the New York Times, after the recent appointment of a major Trump donor to Postmaster General, the organization stopped paying overtime, which led to delays in mail delivery. Experts worry that the administration's continual attacks on the Postal Service may place mail-in votes in jeopardy. Joining me now is Bridget Bergen, City Hall and politics reporter at WNYC. Great to have you as always, Bridget.
Thanks, Tanzina.
Also with us is Christopher W. Shaw, a historian, policy analyst, and author of Preserving the People's Post Office. Chris, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
And you, Chris, get the first question. What are some of the biggest changes you've seen with the Postal Service nationally under the Trump administration?
Well, the biggest one is just what's happened now, where we're reducing the ability to have overtime. And when you have an institution that has seen number of employees fall by tens of thousands in the last 10 to 15 years at the same time that the population keeps growing. So you have more houses, more apartments, more businesses to deliver to. This is a recipe for not being able to fulfill the mission of the Postal Service of delivering to the American people.
Bridget, looking at this from a microcosm here through the New York State primary, which was more than a month ago, the mail-in ballots that were filed then are just being finished counted yesterday. Catch us up. What are the issues that happened in New York?
Well, there are a lot of issues, Tanzina, but specific to the mail-in voting, New York, because of the pandemic, allowed voters to apply for absentee ballots so they could vote from home. We don't have a vote by mail system here in New York, so this was a way to allow people to cast their ballot during this pandemic without having to go to a poll site. And New Yorkers took advantage of that by, you know, a dramatic number, a tenfold increase compared to 2016 with the number of people applying for absentee ballots. That obviously put a strain on both the Board of Elections to process and get those ballots out, as well as the Postal Service, which is obviously the conduit for managing all those ballots. And so one of the things that we saw, in part because there were this opportunity to vote via absentee ballot, was because of executive orders issued by Governor Andrew Cuomo. The laws kind of kept changing throughout the primary season. But to keep on top of all of that, ultimately, here in New York City, ballots went out particularly late, and one of the things that's essential for a ballot to count in New York State is that it needs to be postmarked, and it needed to be postmarked by June 23rd, which was the date of the primary. So just recently, there was a federal lawsuit over the fact that some voters and candidates were saying that too many ballots that were returned to the Board of Elections were being invalidated because they were missing that postmark. And so that was the subject of, you know, a hearing and a decision that actually just came this week, where the judge ruled that many of those ballots needed to be counted, even if they were missing a postmark, because based on the testimony that was given from the Board of Elections and the post office, there had been some problems. So a lot going on there, but also a lot of opportunity to make some changes before November.
Chris, when you hear examples like what Bridget just described in New York, I mean, this was really an issue of postmarks, which I think a lot of voters were probably surprised by. When you hear what's happening in New York and what's going on, what do you think about what the country might be facing in November if, as Bridget suggests, changes are not made soon enough?
Well, we have different systems for what needs to happen to a ballot in terms of, does it need to be on election day? Does it need to be postmarked by election day? And they're different in every state. And so we need to be prepared for this, and we need to have the Postal Service talking to the secretaries of state in the different states to make sure that those ballots are going to be counted.
Chris, are you worried that as we head into this election, that we just mentioned at the top that the new Postmaster General for the U.S. Postal Service is also a big Trump donor? President Trump has often placed people who are very supportive of him in positions of power. But are you worried that that move is politicizing the post office and a service that all Americans, regardless of political affiliation, rely on?
I am worried about that. And I'm also worried about these, when he talks about how the mailing in ballots is somehow likely to lead to fraud or a rigged election, because it really undermines the basic idea of a democracy. I mean, the most important thing we do together as a nation is vote. And these kinds of statements really undermine legitimacy of the election. And I think that's a very, very troubling prospect going forward.
Bridget, what are you hearing from the Postal Workers Union about their ability to do the work that needs to happen for upcoming elections?
Yeah, I've spoken to two of the union leaders here in New York, particularly in Brooklyn, where we saw some of the highest numbers of ballots that were delivered missing a postmark. I talked to Tom McMenemy, who is president of the American Postal Workers Union. He's got about 1,400 members, the retail clerks, drivers, mail processors. And he said, you know, his members are absolutely feeling the impact of these new Postmaster General policies. And it's a real concern to him. You know, as a union leader, he sees it as a real imperative that vote by mail or absentee ballot voting here in New York goes smoothly and works well, and all votes are counted. He thinks that will benefit his members. And the way he said it to me was this whole notion that they would potentially leave mail behind, that goes against everything that they're trained to do. You know, with the Postal Service, it's always about hustling to get the mail out. He also said the pandemic has hit the agency really hard, so they're not working at full capacity, so they need more support in that regard. But he really feels like some of these changes are a disservice. He knows that mail standards have been slowing down over time, and he's concerned that this administration wants to just slow them down even more.
Chris, I'm thinking about historical precedent here as well. Have we ever seen a president take aim at the Postal Service in the way that the Trump administration has?
I can't think of any time when we've had the Postal Service be in the crosshairs of an administration. There has been a campaign going back for decades now to try to undermine the Postal Service as a government agency from libertarians who don't like the idea of government services, and they certainly haven't liked this example of a successful government service that serves the American people universally on a uniform basis, you know, a democratic government service. So that's been going on for a long time, and that's something that the post office has had to contend with for many years. But we've never had a president move aggressively against the post office in this way. It is unprecedented.
I mean, the president has said that mail-in ballots can open the door to voter fraud. This is a big political talking point. I don't believe that there's any proof of that. Chris, have you found any proof of that?
No. I mean, the state that's been doing this the longest in terms of having all ballots go through the mail is Oregon, which has been doing it since 2000. And it's in the case of about 50 million ballots over those past 20 years, it's something like two cases of voter fraud. So it really is not an issue we have to be worried about in terms of the election. The issue we have to be worried about is making sure the Postal Service is prepared and ready to get these ballots where they need to be.
Bridget, you said that this is also an opportunity for improvements to the Postal Service and how New York in particular learned, what lessons New York has learned from this last election. What have they learned? Are there changes going that are going to be implemented before 2020?
Well, I think some of the changes can be implemented by legislatures. And so in the case of New York, what we're seeing is the state legislature saw what happened during this primary, saw what came out during this federal case, and has started to make some policy changes in terms of, you know, what legitimizes a ballot. If you're going to say that it needs to have a postmark, but knowing some of the constraints that this federal agency is operating under, well, maybe you need to make sure that the date when that ballot is received, it makes sense. So in the case of this federal lawsuit, the judge ruled that any ballots received by June 24th or 25th, 2 days after the primary, the missing postmark could still be counted. And there is a piece of legislation in Albany that has already passed both the state assembly and Senate that would allow for ballots received the day after an election, even if they're missing a postmark, to still be counted. So there are ways that state governments can address some of these issues, even if the federal government doesn't give the United States Postal Service what it needs.
Chris, who is most at risk of being disenfranchised if the Postal Service is experiencing the delays it's experiencing ahead of the election right now?
Well, if you look at who we're talking about, it's going to be people in rural areas. It's going to be people who are low income, who are going to have a harder time getting to the polls, and who are going to be more likely to experience delays in terms of getting the mail delivered. But the thing is the mail is slowing down all around the country. So this could be potentially much more broadly based, because the Postal Service is saying we need at least a week to deliver these ballots. And so this could be a broader problem than traditionally the people we're concerned about who are lacking access, being lower income people, rural people, older people. So that's something definitely to keep an eye out for.
I'm just wondering, is there anything that people can do to make sure their ballots actually make it in November?
Well, as Chris said, the rules are different by state. You know, here in New York, you have an opportunity to still vote in person. There's early voting and voting on Election Day. And you can also take your absentee ballot to the Board of Elections office or to any of those poll sites. So there are opportunities there. There's no absentee ballot tracking system in New York, but those are the other ways that you can ensure that you don't have to just rely on a middleman to get your ballot where it needs to go.
Bridget Bergen is a City Hall and politics reporter at WNYC. Bridget, how can postal workers reach you if they want to share information with you?
I'm on Twitter. My DMs are open at Bridget Bergen. I'd love to hear from you.
And Christopher W. Shaw is a historian, policy analyst, and author of Preserving the People's Post Office. Chris, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Amy Jorgensen. I'm from Grosse Pointe Woods, Michigan. I'm a retired letter carrier after 35 and a half years, and I feel completely safe in sending in my mail-in ballot. I don't feel there's any kind of risk in it being lost, stolen, anything like that.
Hi, this is Karen in San Jose, California. And since the post office already handles absentee ballots, I really just don't understand the issue with handling more mail.
I've heard of towns that are offering drop-off locations for absentee ballots for those of us who want to not show up at the polls. And I think that's a much better idea than having the U.S. Postal Service be responsible for so many ballots. It's really not fair to them, given all the other pressures that they're facing and the situation that they're in financially. This is Katrina from Maplewood, New Jersey.
Hi, this is Gail Turner from Richmond, Virginia. As far as trusting the post for the election, start counting the ballots now. Don't wait until the last moment.
This is Teresa from the Brainerd Lakes area. I retired from the United States Postal Service 7 months ago after a 30-year career. We always took ballot handling very seriously. It's an honorable responsibility that postal workers readily accept. I am personally offended by the president's inference that it would be mishandled. He is attacking anyone and any institution that could stand in his way or help with his defeat.
Although I don't have a postman in the family or anything, I do know my postman, both personally, my home postman and my office postman, and they're both incredibly consummate professionals, take their jobs incredibly seriously, and I'm just not worried about them interfering in any sort of election at all. There's no way to alter ballots in any sort of meaningful way. What will obviously alter elections in a meaningful way is to prevent, inhibit, or reduce mail-in balloting and thus reduce voter turnout.
My name is Lee Ogazelic, and I live in Dunedin, Florida. My postman assures me that the Postal Service can easily handle any mail-in ballots, but he has also been very concerned that the new Postmaster General is slowing down the delivery of mail very purposefully, I guess, at the behest of our president, so that it looks like we cannot handle mail-in balloting.
8778-MY-TAKE is our number. This is The Takeaway. A devastating explosion rocked the city of Beirut, Lebanon on Tuesday, killing at least 100 people and injuring thousands. The explosion devastated the port of Beirut and surrounding neighborhoods, causing damage to buildings miles away. Thousands of Lebanese people are now homeless, and hospitals near the area, already overburdened by COVID-19, are overwhelmed. In addition, the country had already been in a deep financial crisis, and many banks have run out of money. President Michel Aoun said the blast was caused by a stockpile of ammonium nitrate that was stored in a warehouse. Ammonium nitrate is used as both a fertilizer and an explosive material. Prime Minister Hassan Diab declared Wednesday a national day of mourning for Lebanon. Liz Sly is the Washington Post Beirut bureau chief, and she's joining us from that city now. Liz, thanks so much, and how are you doing?
Oh, I'm fine, thank you. I'm better off than a lot of people here today.
What does Beirut look like today?
Well, the part that was near the port, which is where I am now, is completely wrecked. I mean, there are no houses here that are habitable. There are no buildings that are habitable. The streets are piled high with glass, wrecked cars. I don't know if you can hear all the falling masonry around me that they're chucking around. I can't get up my stairs because there's stuff blocking the way. And people are sort of wandering around trying to salvage a few possessions. A lot of people have just fled the city. They've gone to their villages outside the city. A lot of Lebanese have homes in villages, originate from villages in the mountains and areas around Beirut. They don't have homes anymore. They've gone. And people are just in a completely dazed. They're stunned. They don't know what to think.
Liz, what do we know about the amount, the ammonium nitrate and that caused the explosion so far?
Well, what we know is there were 2,700 tons of ammonium nitrate in a storage facility. They had been there since 2014 when they were confiscated from a ship visiting the port. And they'd been stuck there ever since. This is the official story, at least. They've been stuck there ever since, despite some people warning that they were a danger. Now, it's all a bit fishy and mysterious. Nothing is ever transparent and clear in Lebanon. You're never sure if you're getting to the real version or not. But that is what the people are saying. And it does, at the moment, look like it was just a case of massive negligence, compounded with some question marks about why this extremely explosive material was being stored there at all.
On Monday, you tweeted that the country's hospitals were near their breaking point. Tell us what how that's evolved.
The health officials have been warning that any day now, Lebanon will overtake its ICU capacity to treat COVID patients, and cases are rising by a very high number every day. So we were expecting to be heading into a serious COVID crisis now anyway. Instead, we now have a massive, massive destruction crisis on top of that. I'm actually sitting in the lobby now of a destroyed hospital. It was near the port. It had 200 beds. Patients were injured. One of the staff members were killed. They had to wheel the patients out. You can see the bloody trolleys outside. They had to wheel them out of the hospital and evacuate them to other hospitals in the dead of night last night with no electricity because this place is destroyed. Meanwhile, there were hundreds of people who were injured in the blast, also converging on all the available hospitals. The hospitals don't have beds to treat all these people.
The situation is dire. There's also been a pretty devastating financial situation on and in Beirut. Tell us what's been happening and how did it get to that point from an economic standpoint?
To put it simply, Lebanon has an extremely corrupt and inefficient bunch of politicians who rule the country. These are basically the warlords who fought against each other during the Civil War. They've now sort of bandied together, and all the money in the banking system has gone. It's disappeared. Nobody can account for it. Nobody's willing to try and account for it. But you're in a situation at the moment where the banks have collapsed, and people can't take money out of the banks because the money doesn't exist. They are limited to very tiny amounts each month. The currency is collapsing at a rapid rate. And I've been talking to people here who've lost their businesses and homes and everything. They just do not have money to rebuild. And even if they did have the money, the banks don't have the money to give them because it doesn't exist anymore.
Liz, I know it's still early days, and as you're saying, people are still shocked. But do you expect, President Trump has suggested that this was some sort of an attack. Does that have any, there are conspiracy theories flying around on social media about what could have happened here. Given your expertise in the region, how accurate would you say that assessment is so far?
Well, it's probably a little irresponsible at the moment because the ramifications of there being some kind of attack are enormous, and Lebanon could end up in a war with Israel, as well as all the other catastrophes that we have here at the moment. But there is a regional context to this, which is we have seen a series of mysterious explosions in Iraq last year that were Israelis targeting weapon storages by Shia militias. And we've had a series of mysterious explosions at power plants and nuclear facilities in Iran this year, which have also been attributed to Israeli sabotage. Now, the port is a very sensitive area in Beirut, partly because Hezbollah, the Shia militia, which is at odds with Israel, does maintain a facility there. They do import weapons there. It's not totally out of the question that some kind of attack triggered the initial explosion that then ignited this stored ammonium nitrate and caused a much bigger one. But this is also Lebanon, and the politicians and the administrators and the management of facilities are so inept and corrupt. It's also entirely plausible that somebody would leave a giant store of inflammable explosive ammonium nitrate sitting around untended for 6 years. That's also well within the realm of possibility.
I'm wondering if, given the pile-on of issues that we just described with banks and hospitals running thin and the virus and the potential for homelessness, do you at some point expect there to be some sort of exodus out of Beirut or out of Lebanon more broadly?
Absolutely. I've spoken to people today who just say, well, I want to leave. I mean, all the Lebanese I know want to leave and wanted to leave before this crisis. And if you've lost everything you have, there's no money or option of rebuilding. I think a lot of people are looking to leave the country at the moment. And that's another tragedy because it's a brain drain and it's a drain of talent and people from this country.
Liz Sly is the Washington Post Beirut Bureau Chief. Liz, thank you very much, and please stay safe out there.
Thank you.
Last week, we mourned the loss of Malik Abdul Basset, better known as Malik B, a hip-hop artist and one of the founding members of the legendary group The Roots. Malik was only 47. Now go get your dictionary and your pictionary. Cause much affliction with my diction, friction, shifts and carry. Words and hers like some cattle in the steeple. People, there's no equal or no sequel. The exact cause of Malik's death has yet to be confirmed, but it fits into a troubling pattern of rappers, especially those from the golden era of hip-hop's early days, dying young from illness. Eazy-E from N.W.A. died from complications with AIDS at 30 years old. J. Dilla died from a heart attack at 32. Yo, yo, whoa, get at me. You wanna clap me? Snitches wanna rap me? Put it right where they back me. Keep my guns close. Prodigy, who was half of the group Mobb Deep, died from choking and complications with sickle cell anemia at 45. Hey, yo, my man Fife Diggy, he got something to say. I told you in the jam that we could get down. Now let's not the roots like the root H-Town. You got BBD. Fife Dog from A Tribe Called Quest died from complications with diabetes at 45. And the list goes on. This is how I represent over this here beat. Dart Adams is a hip-hop journalist and historian, and he joins me now to help us understand why so many hip-hop artists are dying young. Dart, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Just listening to those tracks back to back to back, you just realize that the genius, frankly, that we've lost in the hip-hop community and so young. Dart, what's going on here? Is there something about the industry that's intensifying and creating health problems for these folks? Because these are my contemporaries.
The fact of the matter is that when you work in the music industry, especially when you're signed to a record label, it's basically a new update of the sharecropping ideal. So you get a loan, essentially, and you have to pay it back. And you don't make any money until you recoup that loan. And if you record your album, there's certain costs and overhead. And until you make all that money back for the label, you don't really make money, except for maybe the money you make for shows, which is dependent on how successful your music is. So what I'm saying is, if you're a creative or you're on a label and you're a musician, that you might have to hustle and work three times harder than you initially, you know, hoped, just to be able to see any money, even though you're all over the place and you're visible. So there's that stress added to it. And there's no health insurance that comes with this, you know? So I could run off a list of a whole bunch of MCs that weren't named in your segment that died due to some health issues.
I mean, a lot of these people that we're talking about are Black and or Latino. What role does that race and economic background play into what we're talking about?
Well, okay, I live in the South End, Lower Roxbury. And if you go further down into Roxbury or the Back Bay, there's a big difference between the life expectancy of people who live in that area or Beacon Hill versus Roxbury. It drops like more than 10 years. And if you extrapolate that and deal with, all right, we have a bunch of people from the inner city and they're Black and Latino and they already might have health complications and there's no health insurance in the music industry. If you have any extenuating circumstances with your health going in, it's going to be exacerbated by constantly having to work, go on tour. You can't take care of yourself and you can't take days off, especially now that there's even less money in the industry.
Dar, you've been covering the hip hop industry for decades now. What's it been like to watch rappers start, you know, who were passing away in their 30s and 40s? You said you know other MCs who weren't on that list of luminaries at the top.
Yes. Yes. I mean, when I think about guys like Poetic, aka Grim Reaper, he died of colon cancer, and they had to raise money just to get him treatment. I mean, I have so many numbers in my phone. 2 days ago was the anniversary of the passing of my friend Peyton Locke, who was an independent hip hop producer and rapper, and he died also of cancer. Sean Price died in his sleep. So when you have any type of health issue, we're not getting the help that we need. We don't have coverage and we have to work that much harder just to be able to see any kind of financial benefit or profit. So in this day and age of this exponential age, you know, you have to get above the noise. Imagine how much work you have to be, because you have to do everything now.
Dart, we're talking about illnesses that are manifesting physically for a lot of people, but we're not talking about mental health. And mental health, there's been a lot of talk about that with recent coverage of Kanye West and how the industry perceives or doesn't perceive mental health issues. How has the hip-hop community done when it comes to mental health?
I think there were, in the 90s, we had very few people that understood that what some of the people were rapping about was actually struggling with mental health. Scarface was early doing it. You had other MCs that were just talking about different things, like Notorious B.I.G.'s Ready to Die. That album is talking about his fading mental health while he's trying to hustle and make money and stay above water. These are the same kind of situations that artists now face, especially in a system where you're not making that much money from streaming revenue and you can't tour anymore. So if you had any type of pre-existing health condition, it's going to be exacerbated now because what, you're going to go to the hospital where they might be overrun with COVID cases. You don't want to go to the hospital unless you have anything short of something super serious. And by that time, it's already too late. And we've been dealing with that for the last 4 months.
And right now we're talking really about male rappers so far. But what about women rappers in the industry who often don't get the same attention as male rappers? Do we know whether they too are experiencing the types of illnesses that we're talking about here and other types of health pressure?
Unfortunately, with women, they might be dealing with the same issues, but it's also made worse by the fact they're being preyed upon and they're victims of violence and all these other issues that women have to deal with on top of the things that are going to affect them and their health because they're Black and Latino. I mean, if you look at the birth rate or like the rate of women that die while giving birth or the death rates of children that are Black and Latino, it's insane. When I was told by a couple of people that worked in the hospital.
So, Dart, what are people, I mean, at some point, this is not a new issue. We just went through a whole list of people. You gave me your list of people. I mean, at some point, if the industry isn't doing anything for its artists, what are the artists doing for each other? I mean, are artists beginning to talk about things like that we're talking about right now, just in terms of, you know, the health issues that disproportionately affect Black and Latino communities in particular? I mean, are artists doing anything to protect each other or themselves?
Absolutely. I think that there was a big groundswell of things happening after. So August 8th will be the fifth anniversary of the passing of Sean Price. And when Sean Price passed away, I think that was a big turning point and people waking up. And it happened right after we lost another guy from Brooklyn, Pumpkinhead, PH as most people know him. So these guys were really big in the underground rap community, especially in Brooklyn. And they were tied to everybody from the rap recording world to the freestyle battle world. And when they passed away, you know, people started wanting to be healthier, changing their lifestyle around. A lot of people went either vegan, vegetarian. So there was a whole lot of talk about being more active and being around and trying to survive into your 40s when we started seeing our peers pass away. You know, that there's that line of 40 to 45. And when we start seeing our peers pass away, it starts to really affect you. Especially I have about 25 numbers in my phone. And they've all passed away within the last like 3 to 5 years. And I'll never call them. I'll never be able to text them again. And it's insane to think that I turned 45 in 3 weeks.
Dart Adams is a hip hop journalist and historian. Dart, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Carnegie Hall has welcomed a dizzying array of performers.
To have Andy Kaufman, Frank Zappa, and Birgit Nielsen and Horowitz on the same stage, it becomes this kaleidoscope of our history.
I'm Jessica Vosk. Join me for the new podcast, If This Hall Could Talk. It's all about our unique cultural history, as witnessed by one of New York's most beloved institutions, Carnegie Hall. Listen now, wherever you get podcasts.
For decades, doctors in the United States have performed surgeries on intersex children to make their genitalia appear more like our common perceptions of male and female anatomies.
Intersex is a set of variations and sort of sex characteristics, whether they be gonadal, chromosomal, or hormonal, that are atypical for males and females.
That's Sean Saifa-Wall, the co-founder of the Intersex Justice Project, and we're going to hear more from Sean in just a second. Activists and human rights groups, however, have widely condemned these surgeries, but even after a 2013 report from the United Nations, which called on countries to outlaw genital surgeries on intersex children, most hospitals in the United States have continued to allow them. Last week, the Anne and Robert H. Lurie Children's Hospital of Chicago reversed course, becoming the first major hospital in the United States to officially halt these surgeries for intersex children. The hospital's announcement came after years of pressure by the Intersex Justice Project, a group that works to end these surgeries.
In a statement, the hospital said that historically they had taken part in these surgeries, but that, quote, as the medical field has advanced and understanding has grown, we now know that this approach was harmful and wrong. Joining me now is Sean Saifa Wall, co-founder of the Intersex Justice Project. Saifa, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much.
Also joining us is Kate Sawson, a reporter covering LGBTQ plus issues at The 19th. Kate, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
Kate, let's start with you. Are intersex surgeries common in the United States or in other parts of the world?
Intersex surgeries are incredibly common. From what we know, no hospital has come out and stated that they don't perform these procedures. And almost no country has come out and stated that they won't perform these. Malta became the first in 2015 to say that they wouldn't do that, but very few countries or states have actually outlawed the procedures around the world.
Saifa, why are intersex people and activists viewing these surgeries on intersex children as harmful?
I think the people who are speaking out are the adult survivors of these surgeries. And I think for myself, for the people who I know, the activists, the human rights advocates, is that we have been harmed. And some of the sort of lasting effects, for lack of a better word, of these procedures are like loss of sensation, scarring, like very real trauma. And I think our advocacy is informed by not wanting young people to go through this unnecessarily. I think we have a duty to prevent unnecessary trauma.
Kate, given that the surgeries have been condemned by a number of human rights organizations, as we heard at the top here, why are they still accepted by the medical community as much as they are, given everything also that Saifa just outlined?
You know, there's a struggle for transgender individuals to access trans-affirming medical care, which is medical care that would bring trans people in alignment with the gender that they identify. And so we have an issue in the U.S. of people not being able to access care that aligns with their gender. And for intersex people, they're having the entirely opposite issue, which is they're not having autonomy over their bodies. And it comes back to an issue of, in the U.S., we have a really binary idea of gender, right? We think of men as men and women as women, and we think that these things are written in stone. And intersex people really sort of show that there are variations, and that's really uncomfortable for a lot of us to confront. And so doctors for decades have been sort of writing that out.
I just want to make sure I'm being clear, and Saifa and or Kate, please correct me if I'm wrong here, but being intersex is not the same as being trans.
It is not. The way I think about intersex is that it's a biological reality. But transgender is about how people feel, how they express their gender.
Saifa, in the previous segment, you mentioned, and this was something I've been thinking about, these surgeries, I believe, you call them cosmetic and medically unnecessary. It feels like the cosmetics here are what may have been driving the medical community to do that. Is that right?
Yeah, I think what often doesn't come out is the sort of medical bias against intersex bodies. I think for years, intersex activists have shared how these surgeries have impacted them. I think our messaging has been very consistent over a number of years, since the days of like the Intersex Society of North America and Hermaphrodites with Attitude. Our messaging has been consistent. And I think what often doesn't come out is sort of like provider bias, the bias on the part of the doctors. It was in the Human Rights Watch report in 2017, I Want to Be As Nature Made Me, where it was in that report that it was sort of discovered that surgeons have the highest level of bias toward intersex variations. And their bias informs parents' decisions about doing these surgeries. And so I think definitely, it's like provider bias that's really informing these surgeries.
And it's also, Kate, I'm wondering, I want to talk a little bit about why the hospital decided to end the surgeries. But before that, I'm wondering if you've spoken to parents who may have, you know, with the best interests of their child at heart, decided to do this surgery because they wanted to maybe protect the child from, you know, from anything in the future, or just, you know, have them, you know, were the parents you're talking to, you've talked to, aware of the trauma that these surgeries could entail, or did they do this with the best of intentions for their kids?
I actually haven't interviewed parents of intersex children, but I have interviewed a number of intersex people who have spoken about their parents, and it seems like parents were not given complete information or really understood the consequences of these surgeries and did not understand necessarily how traumatizing these surgeries might be, that they thought that they were doing something that might help their children live a quote unquote normal life, and didn't understand that they might be taking away or foreclosing some possibilities for their kids, including, you know, being able to have children or feel sexual pleasure, or that they'd be subjecting them to really invasive and painful medical treatment for years, or even lying to their kids and telling them, for example, that they had cancer, and that those narratives would be troubling for years and years and years.
Kate, based on the reporting that you've done, why did the hospital decide to end surgeries last month?
That would be because Saifa and Saifa's co-founder of the Intersex Justice Project, Pigeon Pagonis, really fought this for years and waged what I would say was a relentless campaign around this. It's worth noting that Lurie is a very prestigious hospital in terms of gender care in general. It has a renowned gender clinic specifically treating trans and non-binary children that was started in 2013. And it has a really great reputation among LGBTQ people. And because of that, it makes it a very prime target for a campaign like this, because there's such a dissonance when you're doing such great care for transgender people and continuing to do these kinds of surgeries.
Saifa, when you consider your own surgery that happened when you were 13, how did that shape your view of intersex surgeries?
I think looking back, my mom wasn't given all of the facts. I think if my mom was involved in a thorough informed consent process, like, I think she wouldn't have consented to the surgery. And I feel like at the time when I was a child, and these physicians were using terminology that was way over my head, and they weren't being honest with me about the reality of my body. You know, they told my mom that I had gonads, which is undifferentiated sex tissue as opposed to testes. And after I was castrated at New York Presbyterian Hospital, you know, I was put on feminizing hormones, which really caused like another level of trauma, because I saw my body feminized in ways that I was really uncomfortable with. And I think in hindsight, I would have been okay if I had proper psychological support with the changes that were happening. And so I feel like what happened to me, I wasn't given autonomy over my body, because it came with this script that was based in compulsive heterosexuality, that I would have the surgery, be subject to these hormones, and then eventually I would have genital surgery, which would be able to accommodate sex with my future husband. There's so many assumptions that are made, and I think what is pretty disturbing is that there are so many people with the same variation, I have androgen insensitivity syndrome. If they were assigned female at birth, all of them have been given the same script throughout the United States in different parts of our country. So for me, that's a problem. And I think it just shows the consistency by which the medical establishment, particularly around these variations, have these very insular prescribed narratives for people with these variations.
Sean Seifel-Wall is the co-founder of the Intersex Justice Project, and Kate Sawson is the reporter covering LGBTQ plus issues at the 19th. Thanks to you both for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and you're back with The Takeaway. Earlier in the show, we talked about the critical role that postal workers might play during the upcoming presidential election. But there's another kind of worker that's just as important, but in short supply these days, and those are poll workers. As the coronavirus pandemic rages on, communities across the U.S. are scrambling to find people to assist their fellow voters at the polls this November. Poll workers tend to be older, which puts them at greater risk of contracting COVID-19, so many of them are staying home this year. According to the U.S. Election Assistance Commission, more than half of the country's poll workers were 60 or older in the 2016 election. Last Friday, Politics host Amy Walter talked a little bit about this shortage of poll workers ahead of the election. And as it turns out, this has been on the minds of a lot of our listeners.
This is Elizabeth. I'm calling from SeaTac, Washington. I worked the polls in the 2016 election, and I thought it was a really fun way to be involved in the democratic process. This year, I was really considering doing it again, but I'm worried to participate during the pandemic, and it feels like a way to put my family at risk.
Hi, my name is Lori Dowling, and I'm calling from Los Angeles. I've been working the polls for years, probably about 22 years now, and it's an amazing experience. I think everyone needs to do it. This time, I have an issue because of the coronavirus. I have multiple sclerosis, and my husband doesn't want me to go anywhere. I'm less afraid than he is, but I don't think he's going to allow me to actually work at the polls, which really upsets me because this election, more than many, many in the past, is particularly critical.
In places like Kentucky, the Secretary of State has called on young people to step up and volunteer as poll workers in the coming months. Georgia is also ramping up its efforts to recruit new workers to replace those who quit because of coronavirus fears.
Hi, Monica Bell from Dallas. I have never worked the polls before, but if there's a need, I will fill it this year because I feel very strongly that, especially in Texas, we need to do everything we can to get the vote out.
Hi, this is John from Wantagh, New York. I am a poll worker in Nassau County, New York. Traditionally, the poll workers, when I was voting as a younger person, were all older, and now I'm in that category. We really need to encourage younger people to work the polls. I know it's a long day, but it's also a long tradition of making sure that everybody, one person, one vote, gets preserved.
And though some people are nervous about being poll workers due to health or family reasons, the coronavirus isn't stopping others from showing up on Election Day.
Hi, my name is Raylan Almquist, and I'm calling from Quincy, Massachusetts. I do work the polls every year, and I am proud to do it and will continue to do it for this year because I think it's one of the most important elections we will ever have.
This is Tricia calling from Plano, Texas. I've worked the polls several times, including a primary runoff we had earlier this month. I have signed up to work the coming November election, including early voting. This will allow people to come in when there are no crowds, and we have a good safety protocol that we tested during the July election.
My name is Andrea Thomas. I'm from Lancaster, Texas. I have served as a poll worker before. I served as one in the 2016 election, and I will be serving as one in the 2020 election. I see it as my civic duty. I am a Black woman. Many people died so that I would have the right to vote. So I see it as me paying homage to those who came before me and those who died that I might have the right to vote.
What about you? Have you ever worked the polls? Are you considering it this election? Give us a call and tell us your story at 877-869-8253. That's 877-8-MY-TAKE. All right, that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.